Hey there, sports history fan. Arnie Chapman here from the Sports History Network. Now, before you jump into this episode, I wanted to share with you an exciting giveaway we have going on with Home Field Apparel. We have a digital $50 gift card to homefieldapparel.com for one lucky fan of the Sports History Network. All you got to do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways to sign up. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
He was a light-hitting infielder from Brooklyn, New York. He made contact, but didn't pull the ball. He didn't have much power either. He had a good glove, but couldn't find a permanent home in the infield. But he had potential, and the old professor, Casey Stengel, saw something in him. Next, on Sports Forgotten Heroes, we're going to explore the career of a star long forgotten. A star who ultimately found a burst of power and became a favorite of Leo Durocher as well. We're talking about Sid Gordon.
This is Sports Forgotten Heroes, a tribute to the stars who shaped the games we love to watch and the games we love to play. Stars who provided us with many thrills, but when their time was up, they faded away. We'll take a look back at their spectacular careers, their moments of fame, even if it was just for one season or just one game. And now, here's your host, Warren Rogan.
Hello and welcome to Sports Forgotten Heroes, episode number 129, Sid Gordon. As the new baseball season unfolds, what better time to debut the first baseball podcast of the year? What a fun forgotten star to feature, Sid Gordon. Now, I'm pretty sure that most of you have never heard of Gordon. After all, he was not a perennial all-star. He never won an MVP, and sadly, he never won a championship. But let me assure you, for a period of about 5 years, he was as good as anyone. From 1948 through 1952, he averaged over 27 home runs a year. His high was 30 in 1948. He averaged almost 97 RBI a year, with his high being 109 in 1951. And he hit .292 over that span, with a high of .304 in 1950. Gordon played for the New York Giants from 1941 through 1949. He was then traded to the Boston Braves in 1950 and was with the team when it moved to Milwaukee in 1953. Then he was traded to the Pittsburgh Pirates and then back to New York with the Giants, where he finished his career in 1955. And while his career was solid, and he did have that terrific five-year stretch, perhaps his most enduring mark was the way he accepted his fellow ballplayers, no matter their ethnicity. He and Jackie Robinson became fast friends. He took Sam Jethro under his wing and also had a fine relationship with players like Roberto Clemente, Satchel Paige, and many others. Joining me today to speak about Sid is a young cousin of his, Steve Kahn, who wrote a terrific book about Sid, Sid Gordon, An American Baseball Story. Steve has many stories to share with us, and I'm sure you are going to enjoy all of them. Hey, before we get there, please remember, give Sports Forgotten Heroes a like and a nice review wherever you listen or wherever you watch. Follow on X at SportsFHeroes and look for Sports Forgotten Heroes on Facebook. As always, thanks for your support. Now, a lot to cover here, so let's get straight into today's show with my guest, Steve Kahn. Steve, welcome to Sports Forgotten Heroes. So glad you could jump on.
Thanks, Warren. It's really good. It's good to be here. It's good to talk to you.
Yeah, awesome. I love this topic, Sid Gordon. You know, it's one of the fun things about this podcast is I get to talk to people like you who have such a passion for the subject matter of whom you're covering. And for you, it's double that because it's a relative. So yeah. First, tell me how you and Sid are related.
Well, we come from a big Brooklyn Jewish family, and my mom grew up in the same household as Sid. My grandmother and Sid's mom were sisters. One of five sisters who came over from Europe at the turn of the century and all lived in the same apartment building in Brooklyn. I've seen them all together. When I was a child. I needed years of therapy to recover from what they were like. But that's how we're related. I'm not really sure if that makes him a first cousin once removed or a second cousin, nor do I know the difference between the two.
I'll never understand.
He's one of those.
Yeah, I'll never understand that. Here's where I want to really start. The subject of the podcast is sports forgotten heroes. I don't talk about Babe Ruth or Jim Brown or Michael Jordan. Everybody knows about those guys.
Right.
But there are other ball players and football players and basketball players who are great, but for whatever reason, they were overshadowed.
Right.
And Sid falls into that category because if you think about it, there was a 5 or 6 year period where he was as good as almost anyone in the game. But yet not that many people remember or know about Sid Gordon. So for the benefit of those listening or watching who have never heard of Sid Gordon, just how good of a baseball player was he? I mean, during that 5-year stretch from 1948 to 1952, was he not as good as almost anyone else in the game?
Yeah. He really was. And that's what separates those who are forgotten from those who are, in the Hall of Fame and, live immortally as they do that for 20 years. But for that 5-year stretch, I mean, he was in the top three statistically everywhere, would have won a Golden Glove if they had such an award. The other difference is he didn't win a championship, and that makes a difference because that's the folks that we remember. And I got to say, since, we connected, Sports Forgotten Heroes, I've mentioned it to a number of friends, and everybody has their own personal Sports Forgotten Heroes. All you have to do is mention that name with somebody, and you get just a tremendous run-on of conversation. It's just an incredible topic. But yeah, he's one of them, and for that reason, he didn't win a World Series, and he took him a long time to make it to that level. But during that 5-year run, he was as good as anybody.
Yeah, no doubt. The other thing too is, like so many during the period of time that Sid played, he was sidelined when he was in World War II. Lost a couple of years of playing time. How do you think that time away from baseball might have affected his career?
Well, he was fortunate that And the topic of what these guys did during World War II and how the government and baseball work together is a great topic. There's a number of really good books on it. He was fortunate enough to play a lot of service ball, as all these guys did. But he also did sea duty time. He also did time in the Coast Guard and time away from baseball. And of course, you're playing service ball at not quite the same level as Major League Baseball.
Sure.
So I don't know that he, and like Monty Irvin, in fact, claims, if you read much about Monty Irvin and his career, he took him a couple of years to come back and recover from his experiences in Europe. I don't know that Sid had that working against him. He just lost time, in the majors, where productive time in the majors. But, so did Ted Williams. So did Joe DiMaggio. So did Yogi Berra.
Yeah.
So did Gil Hodges. So did everybody who's great. That's what makes him the greatest generation, frankly.
Yeah. Let's go a little further back. Sid grew up in Brooklyn. What was the culture like there when he grew up?
Well, Brooklyn has always been a fascinating place. It still is, but it's always been a fascinating place. I didn't live there in the 30s and 40s, but I know many folks who did. And it was just, you know, teeming with different neighborhoods, and kids everywhere, and sports everywhere, and everybody played baseball. And he couldn't have picked a better place to grow up, because he had two parks up the street, for, you know, in different directions from him where he could play. And there were endless kids and endless games. And it just was where players developed. Phil Rizzuto, you know, is the same way. He just played so much baseball growing up. And he grew up in Brooklyn and then moved to Queens, you know, when he went to high school. And so it was just the neighborhood, those neighborhoods that people kind of long for now that it doesn't exist anymore, just teamed with incredible athletic talent.
What was it about baseball, though? Baseball and Brooklyn. Why, you know, and you could even go back to the Dodgers, right? I mean, it was so heartbreaking when the Dodgers packed up, left Ebbets Field, and went to Los Angeles. What is it? What is the magic about Brooklyn and baseball? Why is there such a connection?
Well, you know, I have a good friend who's from Brooklyn. He's my age, so he didn't grow up during the Brooklyn Dodger phase, but his parents did. And it's still, you know, just a mythical feel. I went to Brooklyn, I think it was last winter. We went to see a Nets game. And I decided I was going to wear my Brooklyn Dodgers hat. So I put a Brooklyn Dodgers hat on. I can't tell how many people pointed out my hat and waved. And I actually saw one other guy just walking down the street with a Brooklyn Dodgers hat. I mean, they haven't played baseball in, 74 years, 75 years in Brooklyn. It's just the tightness of the neighborhood. Sid grew up so close that he could hear, you know, the stadium as a kid in Brooklyn. Yet surprisingly, the Dodgers weren't his team. He was a Yankee fan. He was a big fan of the Yankees. Wanted to play for the Yankees.
Well, back then, who wouldn't, right? They were always winning. You know, Ruth.
He was a Lou Gehrig fan. Lou Gehrig.
Yeah, there you go. You know, that's the other thing too. In today's game, when you look at today's game, most of the players, I guess they come from the South or out West, you know, because the game, they could play it all year long, Florida, Texas, and California. But back then, a lot of ball players, and you mentioned one, Phil Rizzuto, another, Sid Gordon, came from Brooklyn. How good was the caliber of youth baseball and high school baseball all the way? How good was the caliber of baseball in Brooklyn back then?
It was really the mecca of baseball. You know, the world was different then. If you lived in a rural area, you played sandlot ball, but you could barely scratch together enough folks to play a game. Where in Brooklyn, that's what everybody did. In New York City, that's what everybody did. It's what everybody played. You know, it was that they played other sports. They loved other sports, but baseball was just a city passion that it's hard to describe. And you had you know, so much competition, so much time to play, and that it just developed talent. There's a great statistic out there. Major League Baseball keeps track of where players come from statistically. Mm-hmm. You know, how many professional baseball players have come from every state, you know, down to region of the country. And New York, even now, where New York's not producing baseball players like it once did, New York is produced 10 times more professional baseball players than any place in the country, and so has Brooklyn. I can't remember the numbers. I can't remember the statistics, and so I don't want to just make up numbers. But like, if you look at how many professional baseball players have come from New York, it is probably 5 times more than any other state in the country. It's incredible.
Wow, that's amazing. I didn't know that. Yeah, that is. That's pretty amazing, because you would think that with the way the game is played today and where they all come from, I guess still, you know, a couple of New Yorkers sneak in here and there. But yeah, wow, that really is that surprise.
Yeah, it's not really a city game anymore. The game has changed. You're right. If you live in Florida or Texas or California as a kid, you've got a huge advantage because you can play year round.
Yeah. You know, you said that Sid wanted to be on the Yankees. He was a New York Yankees fan. He always wanted to be a Major League Baseball player. What was it about the game that he loved so much? And what was it about the game and how he was able to convince the New York Giants, the San Francisco Giants, you got to educate some people. Most people out there know that the San Francisco Giants used to be the New York Giants, who played at the Polo Grounds, which was almost next door to Yankee Stadium. And the Los Angeles Dodgers used to be the Brooklyn Dodgers. They both went out to California at the same time. How good a youth player was Sid, and what did he have to do to convince the New York Giants to take a chance on him, and why the New York Giants and not the Brooklyn Dodgers and not the New York Yankees?
Those are really good questions. And I wish I had thought to ask Sid that. And what's fascinating about that is that when I did research on this book, I found multiple different stories about how Sid became a Major League Baseball player or had his opportunities, and it was with the Giants. He initially had a tryout. He was one of the better players in the city, and his high school coach at Tilden High School in Brooklyn knew Casey Stengel and was able to get him a tryout with the Dodgers. The original story I read was that somehow there was this private tryout. Later on, I read an article that Sid had discussed. It was about 200 kids that the Dodgers tried out. And they kept cutting kids. And it came down to the end. And he said, I just went up to Casey Stengel and said, do I have a future in this business? And Stengel promised him that he did. And that Stengel said, I'm going to look for a place for you in our farm system. Now, this was during the Depression. So there was not a lot of money. And what happened is shortly after that conversation, Stengel got fired and was no longer there. And that was the end of Sid's, Brooklyn, potential career. He then was just playing sandlot baseball. He played for a year at Long Island University. He played sandlot baseball and played for all the famous, New York sandlot teams. And there's two different stories. There's the story that he was a scout, picked him out of the parade grounds and dragged him up to the Giants' office and said, you got to sign this kid. And they gave him a shot. And then there's a different story that Sid took the initiative himself and marched over and introduced himself to the Giants' management. And, what's funny is trying to recreate history from 75, 80 years ago, I found credible facts to back both stories. So I could only conclude that there's probably some combination of the two, is that Sid took the initiative to some extent, but he got scouted when he was playing sandlot ball, and they signed him to the contract he had. It's a great contract. The contract was, if you pay the bus fare down to Delaware, to Milford, Delaware, if you make the team, we'll give you your $36 back. That it's going to cost. That was the deal he had. But he took it because that was, the only deal a kid in the Depression could get. He made the team within a week. His first minor league at bat for Milford, he had a home run.
Wow. He languished in the minors for a few years despite the fact that he played well down there. Why did it take the New York Giants so long to finally give him a chance? I mean, they would call him up. He did okay, but then they'd send him back down. What was it there? Why did it take so long for him to finally get up there and stick?
That's a good Good question. I'd have to speculate to really answer it. He played a year in Milford, which is what we now think of rookie league, you know, baseball. And then he played in Iowa for what would really be like a single A/double A team. Mm-hmm. And he played great. He played really well. And in fact, the Giants came out and played a short series in Iowa against a couple of different teams, including their own, you know, minor league team. And he shined in the series. And everybody thought, there's all sorts of articles. You read the old Brooklyn Eagle newspaper. He's a sure thing to be brought up to the majors. Now, this is 39. So he didn't make, he got a shot. He was in spring training, just too much talent on the team. Didn't sign him. But they did move him over to Jersey City. He played in Jersey City and he was a huge star. And, you know, being Jewish to some degree helped him, because the Jewish population in New York came out, went out, made the short trip over to Roosevelt, you know, stadium and to watch him in Jersey City. And he was a huge star. Everybody loved him. They actually had a Sid Gordon Day in Jersey City where they showered him with gifts. That's a tradition from days gone by. And he just couldn't get a spot. He just couldn't get a find a role. They kept thinking, is he a third baseman? Is he a left fielder? Maybe he's a first baseman. And they moved him around and they weren't sure what to do with him. And so it took him a long time. He had the dilemma of, he made his major league debut in 1941.
Mm-hmm.
He played in about 9 or 10, 11 games at the end of the season and played well. At that point, everybody was certain he's going to stick with the club. Of course, December 7th, 1941 came, World War II came, and everything was crazy. Most major leaguers stayed and played the 42 season. He did make the team and did play the 42 season. The 42 season was really the last season that had a real semblance of everybody there. And he did establish himself pretty well. And then folks left in 43. And it's an interesting, you know, you wish you could ask people, when you write a book, you kind of have to, while I know the person, you have to think, how are they making these decisions? You got to piece together all the evidence you have. I, of course, talked to his sons. You know, how did he make the decision that I am not going to go into the war? I'm going to play the 43 season. Most players actually did. The vast majority of major leaguers played 43, and by 44, they were all gone. Mm. You know, we look back at history, we know when the war ended and how things occurred. But if you know, in 1943 and 1944, there was no end in sight in World War II. I mean, everybody thought it would go on for years. So it took to those war years for him to really establish himself. And the war years, there's several books on the war years, are fascinating because guys played all over. Sid played everywhere on the field, you know, wherever they needed him that day.
He even pitched.
He never pitched in the majors.
No, but he pitched in those war, in the base games or whatever you want to
pitched,
call it.
He pitched when he played on the great Coast Guard team in Curtis Bay in Maryland. And he pitched a lot of games. I was surprised to see that when I found the old articles of him pitching. I was surprised that he had pitched. And he pitched some barnstorming games. He was used to come in and throw. He was known as having a great arm. Mm-hmm. He could really throw from the outfield. He could make that throw from third base. I don't know that he could throw a curveball. I think he just was a third baseman. Actually, there's an article I read. I can't remember who it was, but who wrote the article, but they were talking about how he pitched, and they said he pitched. It was one of the barnstorming tours. But the sports writer said he pitched like a third baseman, you know, throwing at first.
Yeah. So he finally makes it to the majors. He finally sticks with the Giants, and then, you know, he did. He went into the war. What did he do? Where did he serve? And ultimately, the other question would be, how did it affect his career that he lost those couple of years? For some guys, you know, they left and they came back, and I want to say that they picked up right where they left off. Of course, there was a little bit of a ramp up when you think about guys like DiMaggio and Ted Williams and Bob Feller and so forth. But how did it affect Sid? And what was Sid's involvement in the war?
Well, Sid, so in the spring training of 43, let me get my years right, of 42, at this point, the war is going full steam, and baseball could no longer travel to the South. There was no longer really spring training. Spring training was where you were. The Giants trained in Lakewood, New Jersey. The Yankees trained up the street in Asbury Park. If I'm a Jersey guy, the Yankees got the better deal. They stayed in this great resort right on the beach, and they trained at the local high school and had a great time of it. The Giants were in down the road in Lakewood, and there's some really cool pictures you can find online of them playing in snow flying around and everything. But he got called up for the draft during spring training, as a lot of other players did. He left. He had his physical, and the defense department, the government, decided to take these guys and defer them. A lot of them, they just defer them. You can finish the season when the season's over. You can play. You know, and people question that, but you have to understand baseball was so important to America. The psychology of America, the psyche of America, to close baseball down would have been devastating. Also, the economic value of baseball. You know, thousands, if it's just the players, tens of thousands of jobs depended on Major League Baseball. And this was a time where we were first getting out of the depression. So very difficult decisions had to be made at the higher levels. What are we going to do with baseball? Who's going to play? So he played that last season, and then he went into the Coast Guard. Went to basic training in the Coast Guard at Coney Island, which sounds terrific, except for the fact that it was in the fall and they had to swim in the, you know, they do water training and they swim in the water, and the water is not too warm in Coney Island in November. He was stationed in at Curtis Bay in Maryland, which is right by the Chesapeake. It's a Coast Guard base, and they did a couple things there. They did shipbuilding there. It was right on the water. Uh-huh. Coast Guard's mission in World War II was beyond just patrolling the coastal waters. They actually used the Coast Guard overseas tremendously to supplement the Navy. Mm-hmm. He did, I can't remember the numbers now, but he did about one third of his time. He served about almost 3 years in the Coast Guard. He did about one third of his time of sea time, which was primarily coastal patrols. Right. Yeah. Many Americans don't realize that the Germans took the war to us in 41 and 42 and were right off the coast and were sunk thousands of ships and mined the Chesapeake, and the war was here. And a lot of people don't really realize that. And so the Coast Guard was the frontline defense, and he took part in lots of those different coastal patrols. He also played baseball during the baseball season. You know, they toured pretty locally, Maryland, Virginia, the Carolinas, teams like that. There's actually a great book called Cloudbusters, which is a book about Ted Williams' baseball team during the service. It was a team. It's a fascinating. It's one of the best, to me, one of the most interesting books I've read. It talks about these guys that were in Navy pre-flight training, and they put together a baseball squad and they played, you know, service ball. Ted Williams was on the team. Later, not at the same time, but George Bush, senior, the father, played on that same baseball team. And it was just part of, you know, what they did. So he did those two things. He played baseball. He played some interesting games. He played against Roy Campanella. When Roy Campanella played on a Negro League team out of Baltimore. Gordon's Coast Guard team played against them in 1943. So that's what he did. Right at the end of the war, he got assigned to a ship that was scheduled to sail to Japan. You know, this was when we weren't sure how the war would end, and he was assigned to a ship. The ship, you know, it was a new ship. It got commissioned. It worked up to go to Japan. The plan was this ship was going to participate in the invasion of mainland Japan in 1945. About a month before the boat was scheduled to sail to the Pacific, the war ended with the dropping of the two atomic bombs. So he never left.
And then when he came back, he sort of had to earn his position with the Giants again. Talk about that, how it wasn't, he wasn't able to just walk back in and reclaim his position. But the interesting thing about that is, if I follow correctly, there was some sort of a declaration that when you returned from the war, you were supposed to be given your old job back. So these ball players are coming back.
Yeah.
They might not necessarily have been given the same job they had previously. So how did all that work? And again, Sid had to earn his stay again.
Yeah, he was never a ball player that anybody gave him anything. He really had to earn every at-bat. So in 1946 is the time that, you know, all these guys are back. And that's when the GI Bill came about. The GI Bill was not really designed for baseball. The GI Bill was designed for factory workers and other folks to protect their jobs. You serve your country. You're entitled to go back to your job. But baseball players said, hey, we have a job. It's playing baseball. Why can't I be the third baseman of the Phillies, the Cardinals, whatever? And right. There was an interesting conflict about that. One of the things baseball did is they expanded the rosters in 46. I can't remember the exact numbers, but if it was 25, mm-hmm. it became 32. And they let teams carry more players. Mm-hmm. He went back and he played. He was a starter from 46. He started during the early war years, but he was a starter from 46 on, but he was not a steady starter. I mean, he, mm-hmm. there was always somebody, you know, nipping at his heels.
Yeah.
Is this young guy a better third baseman? Is he a better left fielder? Maybe Sid should be in right. He was a consistent hitter, you know, and if you hit, you know, I remember as a kid playing Little League, if you could hit, they find a spot for you. So
right.
But he had to earn it. I mean, it wasn't given to him. He was just, you know, a scrappy type of player. He was one of those players. I don't want to say a Pete Rose type player because that's not a fair comparison. Pete Rose is, you know, one of the greats of the game,
yeah.
But he played that way. He gave you everything he had every day, and then at the end of the day, he went home, came back the next day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This next question is a really important question. One of Sid's good friends from his day in baseball was Jackie Robinson. How did they meet? And why did they become such fast friends? How much did Sid's being Jewish and Jackie being black play a role in their friendship? Or did it? I mean, after all, they were both longtime targets of bigotry, racism, prejudice, the works.
It's not only a good question, it's a complicated question. And when I began the research to write this book, it was the question I wanted to know the answer to. And I was fortunate enough that Sid's son, his older son, Mike, who passed away 2 years ago, did audio interviews with his mom, who was in her 90s, my Aunt Mary, before she passed away. And he asked that question, the question we all want to know the answer to. How did these guys become friends? And she said, They just were friends. Like, he had other baseball friends. He didn't come home. This is her words. He didn't come home one day and said, I met this black guy named Jackie Robinson. He just, you know, this is my friend Jackie, and here he is. It helped that Robinson moved to Brooklyn, moved to the same neighborhood. They lived a few blocks from each other. Robinson lived on Tilden Avenue, right where Gordon went to high school. They became friends. But it is the Branch Rickey knew he could have the support of the large Brooklyn Jewish community in bringing Robinson to Brooklyn. He counted on that.
Mm-hmm.
And the Jewish population who had suffered prejudice, many of them in Europe, many of them in this country, like lots of other immigrants, embraced Robinson. And it was no doubt that Gordon, who had been the victim of a lot of harassment coming up through the minors, a lot of hostile treatment. I don't know that he never said, nor do his kids say he ever said that he didn't get a fair opportunity because he was Jewish. So I don't think it would be fair for me to say that. But, you know, it was different for him. There were very, very, very few Jewish baseball players at that level. So they had that in common. But it wasn't just, you know, Sid. There were many players who really put their arms around Robinson when he got to the league. But they just became friends. They seemed to have the same interest. Mm-hmm. Their wives were friends. They liked each other. They went shopping. The wives went shopping together for, you know, Christmas presents. They came to each other's house. They vacationed together in the early 1950s when, like, you know, black people and white people don't get in a car and go on vacation or go to dinner, you know, together. They just enjoyed each other's company. There's a whole bunch of fascinating stories on the audio tapes. One of my favorite ones is that they were up in Grossinger's in the Catskills, where folks went back in those days. A lot of celebrities, a lot of athletes went. And there was the story, you know, it's a tortured story of a 94-year-old woman telling the story, but it's a fascinating story. But they had this toboggan race, and they went up to the top of this mountain, and the winner of the race was going to get a bottle of champagne. The hotel had sponsored some contest. So now you got, like, Gordon and Robinson, two uber competitive guys, have their own toboggan teams, and, like, who's going to win the toboggan race became, like, a fascinating thing. And I don't know who won it. One of the two of them won it because they got the champagne. And the other story she told up there, that's the last one I'll take, because they may get crazy, but they wanted to get a photograph of Jackie Robinson, Sid Gordon, and their wives on ice skates on this skating rink. But none of them knew how to skate at all. So they got them on skates, and people kind of got them out there and held them up, you know, so they could balance themselves, and then got the heck out of the picture just long enough to take the picture. So the way Sid's wife tells it is, the others were coordinated enough to be able to kind of get themselves, kind of skate themselves off the ice, but I was left stranded on the ice, afraid to move. So that's just what they did together. They were friends. They were friends like, you know, you're friends with your neighbor. And, you know, Sid didn't see it as it's a black guy, it's a white guy. One of the stories I tell in the book is his dad had a coal business. You know, it started out horse and buggy, you know, dragging coal around the city, and eventually it was a truck. And Sid worked in the business on and off for many, many years. Mm-hmm. And his dad's best worker was a black man. And Sid was a teenager and got on the truck and went out on delivering coal with this guy and spent endless time as a teenager working with him. To him, it was just a guy that he worked with. Wasn't, you know, somebody he should look at differently. Just who he was.
Mm-hmm.
Brooklyn was like that, though, because Brooklyn had lots of different, you know, groups and neighborhoods, and there was joking and competitiveness between Italians and Irish and Jews. They all understood we were all in this together.
Mm-hmm.
what it was like, you know, in the 30s.
Before we really dive into Sid's career, one last question before we get there. You mentioned it before, barnstorming. Sid was big in the barnstorming. It's not something that's done today. Briefly tell us what barnstorming is and how barnstorming helped with the racial divide and why barnstorming was so important to major league ball players as far as a little extra cash.
When I got into this research to write this book, I knew very, very little about barnstorming. It is some of the most fascinating aspects of baseball from an era long gone by. Mm-hmm. Babe Ruth is probably the greatest barnstormer of all time. He'd play anybody, anywhere, anytime for $100 or $10 or whatever the case may be. But what the barnstorming was at the end of the season, these guys would go out on the road and play baseball out in the hinterlands for money. And you got to remember, this is a time when professional baseball is the Northeast. You don't go any further than St. Louis. You don't go any further south than Washington, the Washington Senators. And that's baseball. The rest of the country loves baseball. The South loved baseball back then, and they had minor league teams there, and they had spring training there, but no big leaguers there. These guys would go on the road, and they'd play on the West Coast. They'd play in the Midwest. They'd play in the Deep South for money. All kinds of guys organized all kinds of ways. And it went on for many, many years. Owners tried to stop it. They didn't like it. They were cut out of the action. They had lots of reasons why they didn't like it, but the players did it anyway. Eventually, and again, driven by some of the social advances were initially driven by money. This is a time when the Negro Leagues is out there. There's some great players in the Negro Leagues. People who understand baseball realize there's guys like Josh Gibson and Satchel Paige out there that, you know, who are they?
Great ball players.
Right. So folks realized, and Bob Feller is one of the original guys, Dizzy Dean's another one in the 30s, to realize we can match up black guys and white guys on the baseball field, and people will come and see that. They'll pay a lot of money. They want to see these guys play. They want to see them play major leaguers. And it kind of developed slowly, mostly in the Midwest and in California, the South, you know, in the 30s, 40s, you really couldn't do that safely. Mm-hmm. Though folks loved to watch the Negro Leagues play, they didn't want, there was no interracial play. So, you know, Gordon, I don't know if it was driven by money or driven by the love of the game, played in a number of these games. Trying to research barnstorming is impossible. You just can't.
Sure.
You can't, because there's no real truthful written history of it. You read an article, and then you read another article, and they're totally different stories. You read a book, and some guy will tell you, here's everybody who played everywhere. And then you'll read, and then if you try and research that, half of it's wrong. But Gordon played a number of barnstorming games. All of them, I can't really figure out, because I've seen different stories here and there. But he played in this one fascinating series, which is in the book that I wrote, in 1951, where Gil Hodges leads a team of all white major league players, real stars, Whitey Ford, big time players.
Mm-hmm.
Against a team of all black players led by Roy Campanella. 8 Hall of Famers between the two teams played in this series, and they went and played into the Deep South. And Robinson later on did something similar with Ralph Branca and Gil Hodges in 53. And it became in the 50s more of this, where you had black and white players playing against each other, playing together. The 51 series, the Hodges Campanella series is really the first one like its kind, where real big time stars are playing. But it changed the way people looked at baseball and baseball players, mostly young people, because black and white people came out equally to these games. the whites may have cheered for the whites and the blacks may have cheered for the blacks. But if you read the accounts of these games, when the games are over, the fans came down on the field and they intermingled and
wow.
You know, for the first time.
Wow.
And, you know, people became fans of, you know, Willie Mays played in that 51 series. Monty Irvin played in that 51 series. People began to look at ball players differently. Came a point in time, you know, where you're a kid in pick a town, New York or Missouri, wherever it may be, and you're playing in your neighborhood, you're pretending to be Willie Mays. You're pretending to be Ernie Banks. And that influence changed the way young people looked at not sports, but they looked at society. And all of that exploded after World War II. The changes in society after World War II, the changes in the 1950s, the technological changes, and baseball really led the way socially. It's mm-hmm. fascinating. And Gordon was right in the middle of that. He played mm-hmm. in some of those great games with some of those great guys in all sorts of places. He played with the early, you know, black pioneers of baseball everywhere he went. He played with Roberto Clemente when Clemente was a rookie. He played in a preseason game with the Pirates in Clemente's rookie season, where the Pirates were playing a game in Birmingham, Alabama.
Oh, yeah.
And they wouldn't let Clemente play. Clemente, right?
Right.
So. This is the spring of 1954, right? This is not the 30s. It's 1950. The spring of 55. Wrong. The spring of 55 is his rookie season. And Gordon said, I think my ankle hurts. I'm going to sit the game out. Didn't play.
Yeah.
That's an interesting perspective on who he was. Now, that's his last year of his career. He was a senior guy at that point mm-hmm. in time. Mm-hmm. He felt probably comfortable taking a stand where younger guys wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, years later, baseball pushed these changes through.
Yeah. All right, let's get into his career a little bit. 1943 was his first real big season, and he hit 9 home runs. Comes back from the war in 46. He hits 5 home runs. 47, he hits 13 home runs. In 1948, I don't know if you can answer this question. All of a sudden, he's got power. In today's game, they might investigate him for PEDs.
They didn't have that those days.
Yeah, he goes from a career high of 13 home runs to 30 home runs in 1948. Where did that sudden burst of power come from?
Well, so you got to remember, he's playing home in the Polo Grounds, where, you know, dead center is, you know, 795 feet, maybe. I don't know what it is, some ridiculous amount. He learned to be a pull hitter. Mel Ott and others took him aside and said, you've got a tremendous amount of power. You hit the ball really hard, but you hit the ball 400 feet into center field at the Polo Grounds. It's either an out, or maybe it's a double.
Mm-hmm.
He changed his perspective of how he's hit his whole career. He learned to stand differently. He learned to hold the bat differently. He went through the entire spring.
He hit a ton of home runs in the spring too.
Right. Learning to be a pull hitter and learning to harness his power and drive the ball to left field. Polo Grounds happens to favor lefty pull hitters, but if you look at where he hit his home runs, he hit more than half of his home runs on the road. He just happened to become a pull hitter. He hit some balls like out of stadiums, like, you know,
wow.
record shots. He learned how to be a power hitter is the answer. He was a strong kid who could hit hard, but he was not being productive.
Mm-hmm.
And he spent the time. He was willing to put in the hard work. Even here he is. This guy's been in the majors for a number of years, and someone told him, you got to learn to hit differently, and he did. Mm-hmm. That's the answer of why in 48, 49, 50, 51, 50, hit, I think, an average 27 or 28 home runs a year.
Yeah, which a lot
those days put you in the top, you know, top three or four or five in the league every year.
Yeah, 30, 26, 27, 29, 25, 19, right. And then you know, he slowed down some. Hey, Leo DeRocher, obviously anybody on any podcast, on any show, you could talk hours about the lip. But instead, tell us about the relationship between Leo and Sid. I mean, Leo had a ton of respect for Sid. He even noticed him and had good things to say about him when Sid was on the Giants and Leo was still the manager of the Dodgers. What was it about the style of game that Sid played that Leo respected so much?
You know, DeRocher, you're right. There's books and somebody should do, I don't know who would be Leo DeRocher in a movie.
That's a good question.
But there really should be, maybe there'd be no interest in it, except for baseball nuts. Leo DeRocher movie.
Well, if you go off the field, there'd be a lot of interest.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's true. You could probably do. Yeah. I'm not sure how it'd be rated, but DeRocher is a fascinating guy because he is. I don't know if there's ever been before or after anybody like him. The hardest playing guy. I don't want to say the dirtiest guy because that's not a fair statement, but maybe it is. I don't know. But he loved Sid. He loved the way Sid played hard, played and hustled. And there was a magazine article that I have it on the shelf here. I can't remember the darn sports magazine, one of those sports magazines from back in the day, where DeRocher tells a story about Sid playing a game in 1948 with the Giants, where he's playing third base and there's a pop fly up into the behind third base towards the bleachers. And he says, Gordon ran full speed for the ball, just ran full speed for the ball, dove into the stands, made the catch, came up like, you know, blood coming out of his head, but he's got the ball in his glove. And DeRocher loved that. You know, that's what DeRocher loves, you know, because, you know, he just, that's his style of baseball, is he wants a guy who's going to, you know, give you his kidney to get a double play. And there's a lot of great DeRocher quotes over the years of Gordon. Mm-hmm. If you read news articles, DeRocher's constantly saying stuff about him. It killed him to trade him.
Well, I want to go there. That's my next question. You know, here Sid is a mild-mannered guy, is respected by DeRocher. Plays, you said, like Pete Rose, hard-nosed guy. I mean, the guy played to win the game. He was respected. He played hard. He loved the game. He has his best season with the Giants in 48. He hits 30 home runs, knocks in 107, and hits 299. He follows that up in 49 with 26 home runs, 90 ribbies, and a .284 batting average.
Right.
And then they trade him. Why?
Well, the Giants, I don't remember, what did they come in, fifth? I mean, they, you know, they were fourth, fifth. Yeah, they wanted to win. DeRocher won.
He's your best player.
Yeah. Well, the story behind the trade is a fascinating story. Is they needed to. DeRocher's style of baseball was not long ball hitters. The Giants and, you know, Horace Stoneham loved hard long ball hitters. That wasn't Leo's game. Leo's game was good middle infield, you know, small ball producing runs. And he was a shortstop, you know, and that's how he viewed the game. And he probably wasn't wrong if you look at it statistically. The Giants were losing a lot of games by one or two runs. Mm-hmm. They weren't playing good defense. They weren't getting, and this was, you know, he is a master of the game. They weren't getting those inning-ending double plays. Mm-hmm. So, and then the inning goes on, and the other team ends up with a big inning or scores here and there, because they weren't turning those double plays. And he wanted to change that. He felt that's what they needed. And he wanted Alvin Dark, who was on the Braves. And he sensed an opportunity because the Braves had dissension in the dugout over the manager issues. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to get Dark and he wanted to get a better second baseman. And he always loved Stanky as well. So he was able to get position themselves in a trade where they could get both Stanky at second and Alvin Dark at shortstop, which is what he viewed as a key middle infield, which the mm-hmm. Giants were lacking. And there's a great article. I can't recall the name of now, who it is, who the general manager is for the Braves, who turns to DeRosa and he says, if you were me, would you take that deal? And DeRosa honestly says, yeah, I don't think I would. And he wants one more player. So what he wants is, and it was a multiplayer trade. I mean, the Giants traded like five guys for four as well. It was a very complicated trade. He wanted the Giants to basically say, take anybody you want. If you want Alvin Dark, who was the rookie of the year, I'm pretty sure he was the rookie mm-hmm. of the year that year. Mm-hmm. If you want him, you got to open up whoever you can take. And the Giants were only allowed to protect, I think, two or three players. And Sid just didn't make the list of guys they could protect. And the Braves said, we want Gordon. And DeRosa says, you can't have him. And he says, if you don't give us Gordon, the deal's off. And they made the deal. He went, Horace Stoneman had given him a blank check. You do the negotiating. He went to Stoneman and he said, I made the deal. I got the guys we wanted. It's going to turn our luck around, which it did. But we got to give up Gordon, and Stoneman didn't want to go for it. And DeRosa had to convince him it was okay. Stoneman felt so bad because he had just negotiated. Sid wanted $30,000 a year for his new – I forget what he was making in the low 20s. He wanted $30,000 a year. Stoneman offered him $27,500. And Sid didn't want it. He wanted his 30. And DeRosa came in to the meeting and said, Sid, we love you. You're a great player. 27.5 is fair. Sid said, Leo, I trust you. I'll take the 27.5. Horace Stoneman felt so bad. He felt we took advantage of Sid because in those days, they had to pay him the 27.5. That was the deal. He couldn't go renegotiate his contract with the Braves. Right. He was stuck with that. Stoneman wrote a personal check out of his pocket and sent it to Sid's wife, actually, for the $2,500 that he felt he screwed him out of in the negotiations the month earlier.
That's how much respect he had. And that's also, I mean, that's the
And he wanted him back. He tried and tried and tried to get him back.
And the kind of person that Sid was on display again when he got to Boston. Sam Jethro. Tell me about the relationship of Sid and Sam Jethro and how Sid, you know, coached him along, brought him along.
Right. I don't know if it was, you know, I don't know. It'd be a great question if you could ask folks now, go back in history and ask folks that are deceased why they did things. You know, we just have to, or piecing history together, we just have to figure these things out. But he was either in the right place at the right time or it was something that was important to him. He was on multiple teams that first integrated. He was with the Giants when they brought in Hank Thompson and Monty Irvin. He was in the locker room where it's not as famous, the Leo DeRosa speech, as the one that you see in the movies with Jackie Robinson. But DeRosa gave the same speech. You know, I don't care if he's pink with orange polka dots. He's playing for us speech. And, you know, most of the Giants, you know, this is New York. Most of the Giants, you know, welcome those two guys. The Boston Braves, no team in Boston was integrated. He went up to Boston and the Braves brought in Sam Jethro, who was a star in the Negro Leagues. Just a huge player. He was probably past his prime at that point, but just a huge player in the Negro Leagues. And he became fast friends. Now, I didn't know this. I asked Michael Gordon, Sid's older son, who was probably 12 at the time, Did your dad, I saw lots of pictures of the two of them together, you know, here and there. Did your dad and Sam Jethro have a close relationship? And he laughed, and I didn't know what it was about. And he said, Jethro was at our house all the time. And I said, really, tell me about it. He says, well, he says, I was very good friends with Jethro. He was a great guy. I was real good friends with him. My dad was good friends with him. But we had a housekeeper who was African-American, and Jethro liked her and was at the house, you know, trying to go out on a date with the woman, and did go out on dates with the women, and that was why he was at the house. So Jethro was somebody who was at their house all the time, was part of the family. And, you know, I don't know, because he was African-American, it just was, he was a guy, he was his teammate, and he was his pal. When Sid was, the story behind Sid being traded to the Pirates, Jethro was in the same trade when the Milwaukee Braves then traded Sid and Sam Jethro to the Pirates. Branch Rickey was now the general manager of the Pirates. Mm-hmm. He wanted to integrate the Pirates. There was a lot of pressure from folks in Pittsburgh, African-Americans in Pittsburgh, to integrate the Pirates, and he wanted to do it. He didn't have the same community base of support that he did in Brooklyn, but he traded to bring Sid Gordon in because he wanted Sid there, and he brought in Sam Jethro. Ultimately, Kurt Roberts was the guy he brought in the same time to break the color barrier in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. So Sid is the only guy that I can find in history who was on three groundbreaking teams, the Giants mm-hmm. in 49, the Braves in 1950, the Pirates in 54, and actually Milwaukee in 53, if you think about it, because Milwaukee was integrated in 53. Jethro was a great player. He was the Rookie of the Year that year. He had a great season. It was really the tail end of his career, but a great player, incredible base runner, incredible hitter, fast guy in the outfield.
What kind of ball player was Sid? Let's talk about him on the field. I mean, the guy had power. He could hit for average. Infielder, outfielder. Tell us about Sid's game. And I ask this question a lot. In today's game, who would you compare him to?
Well, that's a tough one. What he couldn't do is run. He could not run. and it hurt him. He hit him to a lot of double plays. Rich Gordon, who we were hoping to have that join us tonight, we couldn't get him, would tell you, Sid used to say, if you hit it far enough, it doesn't matter how fast you are. But he was not a great base runner. I want to say his career high of stolen bases is 9. Maybe it's 11. I don't remember.
And it was 8 stolen bases in 1948.
Right. He did, though, if you go back and you look, when he played in Jersey City, he was actually known as pretty good base runner and fast. But by the time he got to the majors, later in his career, he had a lot of leg problems. And they're described in the newspapers of the day as blood clots. I don't know that there were blood clots. They probably were. He might have just had like chronic, you know, cramping issues. But he was not a good runner. Who of today? That's a tough question. He's a power hitter. I don't know you can, because players are different now. He played everywhere. He played every single position on the field and played it well in the majors, except pitching and catching.
That's right. I was thinking about it, and you being a Mets fan, me being a Mets fan, the name that keeps coming to mind today would be a guy like Jeff McNeil, who plays everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. But that's those guys are the exception.
Yeah.
You know, getting to catching, so Sid knew after the 49 season, DeRosa wanted to make a lot of changes. And he knew that he was going to have to once again scrap for a spot. This is a guy who was an all-star. He was on the 1949 all-star team. But at the end of the 49 season, he didn't feel that he was necessarily secure. So he went to DeRosa and he said, can I catch? DeRosa said, catch? What do you mean catch? And he said, yeah, I can catch. I used to catch when I played in the Coast Guard, and I caught a couple games. And DeRosa said, he's a third baseman. He's got a great arm. Let's try him out at catcher. And he was pretty good. He could have caught. But he was willing to catch. That's actually a great quote. DeRosa's interviewed, this is before the trade, DeRosa's interviewed about that because the story came out about Gordon wanting to catch. And DeRosa said, it's not my idea, it's his idea, but I've seen him catch and he's great and it may extend his career. Maybe he's really a catcher. Mm. So, and except he did pitch, you know, not in the majors, but he did pitch somewhere along the way. So, you know, there's not a lot of guys like that.
Mm-hmm. Look, those 5 years we talked about, 48, 49, 50, 51, 52. I mean, he was as good as anybody. Does he deserve to be in the Hall of Fame? He didn't play. He didn't have a long enough, I think, extended period of time to warrant getting into the Hall of Fame. He didn't play at that level for 8, 9, 10, 11 years. But was he a Hall of Fame talent?
He was a Hall of Fame talent in his prime, no doubt. But, you know, it depends on how you look at the Hall of Fame. But I think I think most people would overall agree that, you know, a 5-year great stretch is not going to get you into the Hall of Fame.
Right.
No championships. You know,
that's the shame. I mean, he played for Boston for 4 seasons, and then was part of the move to Milwaukee. Then he went to Pittsburgh, and then that's when he started with the leg issues and ultimately went back to the Giants in 1955.
Right.
He didn't get a championship, but you do talk about the fact that it almost happened. He almost did play for a championship. The Giants were interested in bringing him back. Talk about that.
Well, you know, the Dodgers wanted him when he was in Milwaukee, and there was always discussions about trading him. But the serious trade is the Giants in 54, in 51, the Giants were in serious negotiations with the Braves for a trade. DeRosa felt he needed pitching, and he was trying to grab one of the great pitchers. You know, he didn't care which one. He wanted to get one of the top pitchers for the Braves. And the Braves wanted Bobby Thompson because they saw him as an up-and-coming star. And so there was a potential deal in the works that would have included a couple player trade in the middle of the season that would have included Gordon and Bobby Thompson in 1951 switching spots.
Could you imagine?
Yeah, it would have been really – I don't know – you know, the world would be a different place if Bobby Thompson was not there to hit that home run. You know, that's not to say Gordon would hit it, but, you know, in the book, I did an interesting analysis of how each player in their career fared against Ralph Branca. And Sid, it's very similar. They each hit 5 home runs. Sid hit about 15, you know, points better. Their at-bats against him is almost exactly the same. The stats are very similar. Of course, the difference is Bobby Thompson hit 2 home runs in the fall of in the World Series, you know, of 19, well, the playoff, and then the playoffs in 1951. But again, in 54, Branch Rickey is the general manager of the Pirates. The Pirates are Sid's the most expensive player on the team. The Pirates are terrible, and while Branch Rickey and Sid Gordon had an interesting relationship. One of the photos we have is a picture of Branch Rickey and Sid together. Sid holding up his jersey when he's traded to the Pirates. Rickey always loved Sid. What Rickey loved more than anything is money, and Sid was cost too much money, and he was trying to engineer a trade back to the Giants. Roger Kahn tells a story in one of his books about having an interview with Branch Rickey at the beginning of the season, and Rickey was trying to convince Khan to write a story in his paper about how Gordon would be great for the Dodgers. He was trying to get the Dodgers, who he didn't have anything to do with anymore, he was trying to get the Dodgers to take Gordon off his hands because he didn't want to pay that much money for Sid at the end of his career. And Roger, he did write the story, but they didn't take him. But he almost made it back twice. So he almost made it back to the Giants in 51, and he came close once again to being traded from Pittsburgh to the Giants in 54, which of course would have put him in a World Series. He did the following May, he was traded back. The season started 55. Interestingly enough, he was one of the reasons that Milwaukee traded him was to make room for a new star, Hank Aaron.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons he in 1954 was the right fielder for the Pirates. His first year, he played primarily right field. And in 55, they had a new hotshot coming up called Roberto Clemente in right field.
Yeah.
Sid played a game. He played a game in like May 25th, I think it is, 24th or 25th, where he's playing left field and Roberto Clemente's in right field. He's traded, and 2 days later, he's in left field and Willie Mays is in center.
Wow. Yeah. Hey, you said early on in our discussion that, you know, Sid never really, the prejudice and the bigotry and all that really never affected. He didn't really experience it. But after his playing days were older, you did make a reference. He wanted to stay in the game as a coach or a manager, but he never really got a great opportunity to do so. And you said that that's also the first time he might have felt some sort of prejudice or anti-Semitism towards himself. Is that the case? Is that, you know, he couldn't get back into the game as a manager or a coach?
Yeah, which is surprising because he was a popular player. His last season in the majors was 55. The Giants waived him at the end of the season. He had a few teams interested in him, but he took a deal with the Miami Marlins.
Not the Miami Marlins we know today, everybody.
But at the time, Miami Marlins, who were a Phillies AA team, everybody thought the Marlins were going to be soon to become to make it to the majors. Mm-hmm. 30 years or more to do it. But he, as a player coach, because he wanted a coach, and he took that position, and he found it difficult because there was a lot of competition between the manager and himself. And what's really pretty interesting, that was he had Satchel Paige on one of his many, many comebacks, was on that team, Miami Marlins team, that Philly minor league team, had Satchel Paige as a pitcher. So Sid played that one season with Satchel Paige, but he didn't really, the press attacked him. You know, Miami in the 1950s was a very difficult city for Jews because there was an influx of Jews to the Miami area and a lot of pushback. Florida was still the Deep South, and there was a lot of conflict between those two. And he really didn't feel he was treated fairly there. The season, he didn't play much. He didn't play well. And he left at the end of the season, and he made a number of attempts to get back into the game. And I get this from both of his sons have said to me, it's the only time he ever said in his whole life he felt he was treated unfairly because he was Jewish. Never coming up, he might have gotten harassed, he might have gotten threats, he might have gotten those things, but he was a kid, he was just part of the way the world was. And he still felt that he could earn his way on his ability. But it was the only time he felt that he really wasn't given an opportunity in the management of the game. Now, is that true? I don't know. I know Sid, you know, from when I was a kid. I know him more from my study of him and my research on him and the hours and hours and hours of conversation with his kids. he's not a complainer. You know, he's not one who blames somebody else for because he struck out. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if it's true or not. You know, the world was a totally different place back then than it is now. But that was his perception. And you would think, you know, most of his contemporaries, guys he played with, many guys he played with that he was better than, had that opportunity and coached and managed. So,
Hey, it's been a fascinating hour, Steve. I really love this discussion, but we're going to have to wrap it up. So in the end, how do you sum up the career of Sid Gordon?
You know, that's, well, first of all, I want to thank you for having me in this topic on the show. The Sports Forgotten Heroes is, I'm a big fan of it.
Thank
and,
you.
And I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about baseball, our mutual love of the Mets and Sid Gordon. So I want to thank you. I don't know. He's one of those guys who played the game at a high level. He played it for the love of the game. You know, we talked about the Hall of Fame before, and the Hall of Fame has got a couple hundred of the greatest players of the game. But there's hundreds of other guys, thousand other guys who played the game and made a difference. They made a difference for kids in the stands, the fans, their communities. They played the game the right way. They didn't cheat. And at the end of the day, you know, their character and how they played is more important. And that's really, I think, what his legacy is.
Yes.
And that's how I think he would be most, you know, proud, and his family would be to be remembered as a good guy who played, gave the game everything he had, loved the game, and was honest to the game.
Awesome. Well, again, Steve, thanks so much. And hey, I encourage everybody out there to grab a copy of Steve's book about Sid Gordon.
You got it right. Here we go.
There you go. Sid Gordon. Great book. Really, it was a fun book to read. You go really in depth. We didn't cover a whole, everything that was in there. We could talk about Eisenhower and how, you know, his experience might have actually changed the world we live in today had something, some sort of a truth been told. Perhaps not. But yeah, great book. And Steve, I really appreciate you spending so much time with us. And yeah, this was great. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Warren. I look forward to seeing you again.
Absolutely.
For his career, Sid hit .283 with 202 home runs and 805 RBI. Certainly a solid career. And who knows how much better it could have been had he learned to pull the ball sooner and if he was a member of the famous New York Giants team of 1951. Thanks to Steve for sharing so much with us, and thanks to all of you for your support. And we'll see you next time on Sports Forgotten Heroes.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Each week, the official Football Learning Academy podcast will take you deep into the history of pro football through interviews with players, coaches, or administrators in the NFL, as well as interviews with Pro Football Hall of Fame selectors, authors, and historians. You'll learn how the game evolved and important moments that shaped the sport into what it is today. And don't miss the Pro Football History Nugget of the Week. Listen to the official Football Learning Academy podcast on the Sports History Network.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcast. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcast. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.